From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Supreme Court justices like to call the other branches of government the political branches, implying, of course, that the court is where the law, not politics, plays out. But politics have long been part of the nomination and confirmation processes, and with the extraordinary acrimony of the Kavanaugh nomination, could the court now find itself becoming permanently politicized? Will the public see the court as just another assemblage of Republicans and Democrats, rather than fair jurists who weigh the legal merits of the cases before them? And if so, what are the consequences of that? This hour on Point, legitimacy, integrity, and the United States Supreme Court. You can join us on air or online. Has Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation process changed your view of the Supreme Court itself? Do you believe it's still beyond reproach or turning into another political branch of government? And what are the long-term impacts of this nomination process? No matter how it ends up, what are the long-term impacts on the nation's highest court? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're joined this hour by Dahlia Lithwick. She's courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast. Her story in Slate on Friday is headlined "Fear a Justice Brett Kavanaugh," and as his confirmation steamrolls ahead, Americans should be terrified. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org, and Dahlia joins us today from East Hampton, New York. Welcome back to On Point, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today from Washington is Stuart Taylor, author and contributing editor for the National Journal. Stuart Taylor, it's good to have you as well.
Nice to be here, and hello, Dahlia.
So I want to start out actually with the voice of a Supreme Court justice, because last Friday, on September 27th, this was just the day after Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, it just so happened that Justice Elena Kagan was speaking at a University of California, Los Angeles law school forum. Now, I should note, I watched the whole forum. It was about an hour and a half long, and Brett Kavanaugh's name was not mentioned once, neither by Justice Kagan or by the UCLA moderator, the law school dean, Jennifer Mnuchin. But I want to play a bit for you both here anyway, because I think it's as close as we're going to get to knowing what's inside the minds of justices right now. And there was this really interesting moment where Dean Mnuchin asked Justice Kagan about the lessons that the justices had learned when they only had eight members on the bench after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. And Elena Kagan said the court has a real interest in preserving its institutional legitimacy. And then she said this.
The court's strength as an institution of American governance depends on it having a certain kind of legitimacy, on people believing that it is not simply an extension of politics, that its decision-making has a kind of integrity to it that is something different from what you find in the political branches. And if people don't believe that, they have no reason to accept what the court does. And that would be a great shame, that one of the beauties of our system of governance is that for many, many, many years, with a few exceptions, but incredibly few, really, even when the court has decided some really hotly contested issues on which people feel strongly, the court's decisions have been accepted and that nobody said, look, why should I pay attention to that?
That's Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan just last week on Friday at UCLA. Dahlia Lithwick, how concerned are the justices right now about the public's trust in the nation's highest court? Dahlia Lithwick, are you there?
I am here.
Hi. So let me ask you, let me just repeat that question. How concerned are the justices right now in the public's trust in the nation's highest court?
I think they're extremely concerned. I had a similar, actually, back and forth with Justice Kagan at an event, I think about 2.5 weeks ago, and she said very similar things. She said, you know, we have this notion that the court has this ineffable, immutable, magical power, and that that is unshakable, but that the truth is, and I mean, this goes back to Federalist 78, you know, Alexander Hamilton wrote, the court has neither the purse nor the sword. It has neither force nor will. It has nothing. All it has is the esteem of the public and the conviction of the public that the court isn't just a political branch. It's not just power. And I think it's one of those strange things, and I think this is what Justice Kagan was hinting at, where everybody knows this to be true, but nobody actually says it outright. And then when you see in the moments, for instance, right after Bush v. Gore, where the public confidence in the institution is shaken, that it takes years to recover. And so I think what Justice Kagan is saying is probably what the other justices are feeling in some measure, which is this is a very, very deep blow to confidence, public confidence in the institution. And in the end, that's actually the only power the court has.
Well, so Stuart Taylor, I mean, so if indeed there is a deep blow to public confidence going on right now, I mean, what impact does that have on the court? What are the practical implications of that?
I think as both Justice Kagan and Dalia indicated or implied, the practical danger is that the court will become regarded as such a cynically political institution with party line voting, Republicans versus Democrats by both sides, with all of the justices or some of them or most of them voting for political reasons rather than legal reasons. I think that's a great danger. And the ultimate danger is that the court will become so devalued in the eyes of the public that people won't feel obliged to heed its decisions. Now, there's a long history here, more than two centuries of partisan brawls in which the Supreme Court has become involved, right since the first Chief Justice, John Marshall. But in the last 50 years, something has changed. We've evolved to a point where the Supreme Court is the lawgiver on almost every big controversial rending issue facing the country. Congress has been paralyzed, and the Supreme Court has been pretty assertive in taking control of all kinds of areas. It's hard to think of an important area of American life where the Supreme Court does not have the last word. Maybe the budget, but certainly on race, abortion, sex, a whole list of things. So when you have the Supreme Court that not only is making all these decisions, but that now has four Republicans, four Democrats. The Republicans are all conservatives. The Democrats are all liberal. This is fairly new in American history. Mm. And, of course, if Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, it'll be 5-4. And also you've had, you know, things like the partisan comments he's made attacking the left, attacking the Democrats in the Senate. That doesn't help. Maybe understandable when you think about what he's going through. But it's not just him. The most explicit attack on any president in memory that I can think of was made by liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, much as I respect her, against President Trump, I disrespect him.
During the election, right? She was speaking
during the election. Yeah. She did it more than once.
Yeah.
And it's not the first time she's spoken out in a partisan way. So, and others, I think, on the bench, certainly haven't ever heard Justice Kagan, who do anything like that. I have never heard the Chief Justice. But we're heading in a direction where that sort of thing is starting to happen. And, of course, this whole proceeding, whatever else you think about it, has greatly aggravated it and put a spotlight on the bitter partisan divisions on the court.
So, Dalia Lithwick, I want to pick up on something Stuart Taylor said about sort of if we go through the thought experiment of the ultimate consequences of the politicization of the court. I mean, there's the implication that, I mean, even as Justice Kagan said in that clip that we played, that if people don't believe that they have any reason to accept what the court does, that would be a great shame. I mean, I'm going to give a hat tip to Molly Ball and Tessa Berenson in Time magazine, because they looked back and saw, you know, for example, in 1832, President Andrew Jackson disagreed with a Supreme Court decision under then Chief Justice John Marshall. And President Jackson said, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. I mean, is it possible? Do you think it's even realistic for us to think that we could be headed in that direction where there's such delegitimization of decisions coming out of the court if the politics continue, that we'll have people even within government saying, why enforce the rules coming or the decisions coming out of the court? Dalia, we're going to have to try and call your phone back because it's a really rough line here. So we'll do that here in just a second. But Stuart Taylor, I'll just turn that same question to you. Do you see, maybe just elaborate on the point you were making earlier, do you see it possible that we would end up there in the 21st century?
Yes, I can see a possibility that we'll end up there within 5 years. And President Trump, has not helped. He has not frontally attacked the Supreme Court, but he has frontally attacked the legitimacy of various federal judges and various federal court decisions, especially those against his travel ban. Now, I have my doubts about some of those decisions, but it was very unusual, if not unprecedented in modern history, for the President of the United States to attack the legitimacy of judicial decisions that he didn't like, including the so-called Mexican judge who made a decision he didn't like about his private business. This is very dangerous. And frankly, what the Democrats and the Judiciary Committee are doing when they pronounce Judge Kavanaugh evil before he says a word in testimony, not all of them did that, but Cory Booker did, and all of them rushed to judgment against him almost the instant that people started surfacing sexual misconduct charges against him without pausing to see whether there was much to them.
Okay, so you say we could be at a very dark place within 5 years, Stuart Taylor. I mean, we just got 30 seconds to go.
Here's how it could happen within 5 years.
We got 30 seconds before the break, though. Go ahead.
Kavanaugh gets confirmed. The Democrats are furious. The Democrats sweep Congress and the presidency in 2020 election. They pack the court, which Roosevelt tried to do in the 30s but didn't succeed. You can pack the court by increasing the number of members and appointing ones you like until you've got a majority. And that's a game two sides can play.
Well, you're listening to Stuart Taylor. He's author and contributing editor for the National Journal. Dahlia Lithwick is also with us. We're going to get her back on a better phone line. She's courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast. And we're talking about the legitimacy, the integrity, and the public trust in the United States Supreme Court and whether our politically fraught nomination and confirmation process is undermining that legitimacy and what the effects of that could be. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the legitimacy, the integrity, and the public trust in the United States Supreme Court and whether or not the court itself is becoming more politicized over time. I'm joined today by Stuart Taylor. He's author and contributing editor for the National Journal. Dahlia Lithwick is also with us. She's courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast as well. And I want to just go through a kind of a little walk through history here in terms of moments for different nominees where politics definitely came into play. First of all, let's go back to 1987. Here's then Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork in a press conference in October, 2 days after the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to have his nomination put before the full Senate with the recommendation not to consent to the appointment. And obviously, Robert Bork ended up not being elevated to the high court. And here he talks about the lasting effects of the politics involved in his nomination.
The most serious and lasting injury in all of this is not to me, nor is it to all of those who have steadfastly supported my nomination and to whom I am deeply grateful. Rather, the damage is to the dignity and the integrity of law and of public service in this country.
Robert Bork in October 1987. Fast forward then to October 1991, and here is then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas addressing the Senate Judiciary Committee about his confirmation hearings.
This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
Clarence Thomas in 1991. Now, move forward still to Merrick Garland, who President Obama nominated. And we can't play any tape there because he never even got a hearing. So that takes us then to where we are now in 2018. And just last week, Brett Kavanaugh defended himself before the Senate Judiciary Committee, claiming that Democrats had politicized this process and developed, quote, a long series of false last-minute smears to block his nomination.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
Dahlia Lithwick, hoping your phone line's better. You with us now?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great, Dahlia. Thank you so much. So let me just ask you, hearing sort of those voices through history, is what we heard last week with Brett Kavanaugh categorically different than the politics that came before in previous nominations?
You know, I think it was. I think that there's some perfect symmetry. We started with Robert Bork. What Robert Bork did at his hearing that was probably tactically a mistake was he talked really in fulsome, clear, and very, very certain ways about his own views. There's a reason that people stopped doing that after Bork and learned to say, I'm just a robot and a neutral umpire. So in a sense, what Robert Bork was being borked over was, in fact, how he thought about judging, how he thought about the Constitution. Then when you fast forward to last week and Judge Kavanaugh, you have a very, very strange, almost a mirror image where since then there's this long tradition of judges, including judges, by the way, with very, very, very extensive legal records, records of writings, records of speeches and communications, and records of their actual doctrinal views, standing up and saying, but I'm also just a robot. I have no views, balls and strikes. And in a weird way, I think that Robert Bork was the last time we had anything close to a truthful scrutiny of someone's record. Now what we have is this funny pantomime where the nominee pretends that they actually have no views at all and nothing they wrote in the past has any bearing. And I think that sets up what we saw this week, which is you have a nominee who has a very, very clear, very coherent doctrinal record, and he spent most of the hearing trying to get away from it. Now, that doesn't answer the question of whether Brett Kavanaugh did something really dramatically different when he started talking about dark money and the Clintons, because I think that's a given. I've never seen anything like that. But I think at least Bork was honest, and he was, when the Senate exercised its advise and consent, it did so knowingly.
Yeah.
That's gone.
Well, Stuart Taylor, I mean, I guess the question that naturally raises itself here is the court being undermined by what is fundamentally seen by many as a broken nomination and confirmation process that precedes any justice's elevation to the high court?
Emphatically, yes. And I've been watching it happen and get worse and worse and worse since before Judge Bork. A year before Judge Bork, Justice Scalia, who was then a very controversial figure, was confirmed like 98-0, I think, or maybe it was 98-2. I think it was zero. Bork, I can understand why the Democrats didn't want him to get confirmed, because his record showed that he was going to be bad for them on almost every issue. And even then, what I said earlier was true. Everything, you know, they're deciding many of the most important political issues in the country. It's almost impossible to be a neutral arbiter when that's what you're doing. But what the Democrats did with Bork and what made Bork a verb was they smeared him in every conceivable way except his sex life. They smeared him as a liar, as a monster. They portrayed him as a horrible person. They took out advertising. It was a disgusting display. Mm. You know, now this is how they thought they could win. Now with Thomas, it was more complicated. With Kavanaugh, who, you know, for all of the comments lately and understandable comments about his odd performance in front of the committee, he's been on the bench for 12 years. at the second highest court in the land, arguably, sitting along with 15 admirable judges, including my law school friend Merrick Garland, and we know what happened to him. I have it on good authority, and it's pretty public, that every one of those judges, or at least almost every one of them, including Judge Garland, I believe, admired him in terms of his judicial temperament as a level-headed, smart, wonderful colleague who was much more conservative than some of them in some ways, but who is an excellent colleague.
Yeah.
You know, now that's not what he looks like. The person we saw on TV the other day was totally out of character for Kavanaugh, and this process, I think, drove him in that direction.
Well, and Dahlia Lithwick, I mean, we're creeping towards looking at Congress's role in all of this. I mean, there's the politics that play out between Democrats and Republicans in those hearings themselves. But also, I mean, after Harry Reid first, you know, launched that nuclear option or pushed the nuclear option button in 2013, and then Mitch McConnell did it after that for Supreme Court nominees in 2017, that removed, you know, what was the most effective break in terms of bringing more controversial justices to the nomination process, right? So, I mean, we have to be looking at the Senate and its role here in creating this highly politicized environment for the court.
I don't think there's any question. I think that the fact that we're talking about, what, 1-2 votes, we're talking about Jeff Flake and Susan Collins, and the totality of this seat rests on 1 or 2 people's votes. It really, I mean, I couldn't agree more with Stuart that, you know, Justices Ginsburg and Justice Scalia often say or said in Scalia's case, look, this used to be a 98-0, this used to be a 94-0 enterprise, because the rule that everybody adhered to in the Senate was elections matter, and if the president chooses someone who's fit, we don't go after them because of perceived outcomes. And that's clearly just gone. I would probably say that the holding of Merrick Garland's seat open, and in fact, I would say the running on the proposition, right? Because Ted Cruz and John McCain ran in the 2016 election for their Senate seats on the open promise that we will keep that seat open. Not only is Merrick Garland not getting a hearing, but if Hillary Clinton wins, we will hold the seat open for 4 years or 8 years. That seat is not going to be chosen by Hillary Clinton. So this not only got weaponized in the ways that Stuart's describing, but it's now kind of an electoral promise that both sides, I think probably Republicans did it more decidedly in 2016. But if you have people openly running on holding seats vacant for 8 years rather than let the president of the opposing party seat someone, it's hard to say that this is anything but irreparably broken in the Senate.
Well, I want to just quickly listen to some comments that Chief Justice John Roberts made a couple of years ago. This was in February 2016, 2 weeks actually before Justice Antonin Scalia died. And Chief Justice Roberts was at New England Law School, and he was very critical, sharply critical of the confirmation process even then, you know, saying that, quote, it's not functioning very well. The process is being used for something other than ensuring the qualification of the nominees. And then he talked about how that might harm the court.
When you have a sharply political, divisive hearing process, it increases the danger that whoever comes out of it will be viewed in those terms. You know, if the Democrats and Republicans have been fighting so fiercely about whether you're going to be confirmed, it's natural for some member of the public to think, well, you must be identified in a particular way as a result of that process. And that's just not how, we don't work as Democrats or Republicans, and I think it's a very unfortunate perception that the public might get from the confirmation process.
That's Chief Justice John Roberts in February of 2016. I want to bring in another voice here. Christopher Schmidt joins us. He's professor of law at the Chicago-Kent College of Law and legal historian and co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. Christopher Schmidt, welcome to On Point.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So you just heard that tape from Chief Justice Roberts in 2016 saying that the court doesn't work as Democrats or Republicans. But does that even matter anymore when the people nominating and debating these nominations definitely see them almost as political appointments? I mean, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma said Democrats are going to try anything they can to keep us, quote, from having a conservative Republican majority on the United States Supreme Court. He's not saying, you know, a conservative jurist. He's saying Republican majority on the United States Supreme Court.
No, I think Chief Justice Roberts certainly has a strong point when talking about how the confirmation process is going to have an impact on how people view the Supreme Court. I do want to push back a little bit and just recognize that historically, the American people have been able to separate the experience of the confirmation process from their assessments of the court. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find basically anyone saying anything good about the confirmation process. It has critics across the ideological spectrum. And we recognize that there's obviously a connection between what happens in the Senate during the confirmation process and what happens at the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court does go about doing its business, and the Supreme Court does a lot of things that helps put that whole confirmation process in the rearview mirror. So we see these incredibly intense confirmation processes where the individual nominee really becomes the symbol of the court. Right now, Brett Kavanaugh is the symbol of the court in many people's eyes. But that will pass, and it has an effect on the court. But it's usually not as, or at least history has proven that it hasn't been as catastrophic as some of our worst fears tend to have been.
Right. But Christopher Schmidt, though, let me ask you a question, because I think, you know, as Dahlia at least said before, I don't know if we've heard a nominee, even in these like intense, acrimonious processes, be as overtly political as Brett Kavanaugh was last week. And I think in the minds of many, that is this new turning point that we're at, that people are asking questions about whether or not that politics will fundamentally carry over into the court if he is indeed made a justice. I mean, we've got folks saying, will he have to recuse himself from any number of cases if, you know, left-wing advocacy groups are bringing cases before the Supreme Court? I mean, do you see this as a different moment at all?
I think we have to wait and see. It certainly is uncharted territory. And then the question is it actually a turning point in the legitimacy of the court? The court is surprisingly durable as an institution. It takes a lot of hits. Its overall approval ratings have dropped moderately in recent years, but pretty much in line with other major institutions of our society. Just people generally have less faith in our institutions and society. So the question is whether there's going to be a spillover with this particular moment on the court. And I think clearly there is going to be something. The question is how significant it's going to be. Right. You can just imagine the court is going to put its head down for a few years with Brett Kavanaugh or without Brett Kavanaugh. And they're probably going to try to be a little less controversial, a little keep away from some of the headlines. And then the question is, a few years from now, we'll have to look back and see, where is the court now and what do people think about the court's doing now?
Mm. Stuart Taylor, do you share Christopher Schmidt's optimism that after the heat of this moment sort of ebbs away, that confidence in the court will reemerge?
I think Christopher made a very good case, but I'm not as optimistic as he is, in part because the Supreme Court can't back away. All the biggest cases, all the biggest controversies in American life are dumped on its doorstep over time. You know, they can duck some cases, but they can't duck every case. And they're not going to want to duck every case because a lot of them feel passionately about the issues and want to score one for their team. And unfortunately, when I say want to score one for their team, that may not be the way they think of it, but that's the way it looks. And with the uniform trend since before Bork, during Bork, Thomas, has been every new season makes things even more partisan than before. The Democrats and the Republicans are playing even more remorseless battles against each other than they did before. The quality of the nominee as a human being or as a legal mind recedes in importance. Whatever the nominee's perceived votes are going to be takes over. And as long as that's the case, I think it's going to be a downhill slide of the court into less and less respect and perhaps eventual impotence.
Dahlia Lithwick, how then do we begin to roll back from the brink here? Because if really the pieces that have been put into place in Congress and specifically the Senate are part of the reason why we're here, the court really is powerless to do anything about that. It's the Senate that has to remedy itself. And the politics there are even worse.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think one suggestion that I don't disagree with is that one of the turning points was when we started televising these hearings, both because I think it ratchets up the incentive for senators to do a lot of what you saw, which is chest thumping and thundering and performing, you know, some kind of weird dominance that really is so bad for the court. I mean, you are literally seeing the single most toxic conversation about what judges do. And then, by the way, because the court doesn't televise or even audio cast its own proceedings, you have witnessed, you know, the entire public has witnessed this horrific spectacle, and they don't actually see the justices doing their job, yeah. which is most of the time just incredibly boring, pedestrian oral arguments in which they don't come out in these 5-4 arrays. And so,
Dahlia, I'm going to have to just pause here for a second because we got to take a break, just 10 seconds off the break. We're talking about the legitimacy and the integrity of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the legitimacy, the integrity, and the public trust in the United States Supreme Court. And I'm joined today by Dahlia Lithwick, Stuart Taylor, and Christopher Schmidt. And I want to play just a couple of clips here. This is from last week. And first of all, you're going to hear Republican Senator Lindsey Graham being asked by a reporter if the hearings that were held on Thursday could have an impact on the Republicans' vote on Brett Kavanaugh.
If you can ignore everything in this record, look at an allegation that's 35 years old, that's uncertain in time, place, date, and no corroboration, if that's enough for you, God help us all as Republicans, because this happens to us. It never happens to them. But let me tell you, my Democratic friends, if this is the new norm, you better watch out for your nominees.
Senator Lindsey Graham last week. At last week's confirmation hearing, Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, said that all the recent, quote, hysteria is because Supreme Court nominations have become so politicized.
We have a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the Supreme Court in American life now. Our political commentary talks about the Supreme Court like there are people wearing red and blue jerseys. That's a really dangerous thing. And by the way, if they have red and blue jerseys, I would welcome my colleagues to introduce the legislation that ends lifetime tenure for the judiciary. Because if they're just politicians, then the people should have power and they shouldn't have lifetime appointments.
That's Republican Ben Sasse last week. Dahlia Lithwick, before the break, I had to interrupt you there so that we could take that break. But you were talking about the fact that people are seeing politics in the nomination process, but they don't actually get a chance to see in great detail the court doing its actual work and the consequences of that.
That's right. And in some sense, I think Senator Sasse put it better than I did. You know, if you all you see is people in red and blue jerseys in the Senate turning it into a blood sport about getting a red or blue justice on, it's a little bit hard to say the public isn't going to take that away with them. And I think, you know, the only other thing I would add is we've been talking about the public perception of the justices, but I think it's probably worth just threading into the conversation the justices' own view of these things. We know, for instance, that Clarence Thomas never fully recovered from what he thinks was done to him in his hearings. We know that Sam Alito has said that he's never quite forgiven or forgotten how his hearings went down. It's really hard to imagine that if Brett Kavanaugh is elevated to the court, he will look at some of the groups that attacked him in anything resembling an objective, open-minded way. So there are real consequences, not just for public perception of the justices, but the justices' perceptions of the public. And that's something that I think we really do have to factor into yeah. this conversation, too.
I'm going to get to some callers here because we've got folks who've been waiting very patiently on the line. But Christopher Schmidt, I just want to ask you a quick question here, because, I mean, isn't there evidence enough or perhaps ample evidence in the justices' own voting or records in the decisions that they make that perhaps, I don't know, if it's fair to say politics already plays a role in how the court operates, but that one can wonder if that's true when we have justices that are much more often than not, you know, voting in line with the with what would be the perceived preferred vote of the president that nominated them and put them on the court to begin with.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. But it's also nothing new. We knew this before Brett Kavanaugh came on the scene as a nominee for the Supreme Court, that politics play a role. It's always played a role in some sense. And I'll also say, if you look at the American people's attitude toward the court, most people actually don't think that the court does not involve itself in politics, that politics doesn't play some sort of role in the court. And people oftentimes do have an ability to say, yes, there are politics at play here, but the court still has legitimacy even independent of that. So it's not the idea that once people see it as in some ways a political institution, automatically its legitimacy is lost and no longer people are going to follow its dictates.
Well, let's go to calls here finally. And thank you, everyone, for waiting so patiently on the line. Let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air, Aaron.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting topic. I want to get this in, so I'm going to speed through it. First of all, the point or question is, has the legitimacy or integrity or public trust been lost through perception? And if you think about what happened with Obama not being able to appoint a justice to replace Scalia because of Republicans saying we will not let him do it, that politicized it in the public's eye. Now, we know that the American public is probably the most propagandized, easily manipulated populace in modern history. And so through the media and through a lot of other things, they are giving a perception of what is and what is not. But through these last several months of Donald Trump and his blatant disregard for the Constitution and Republicans with this stomp down, we're going to do this regardless because we're Republicans and we're going to go against whatever Democrats say and da-da-da-da, I think the public trust has been shaken, and I believe the integrity of the court is gone, and I believe, like one of the other statements were made, that we need to put some kind of limit on terms now because it is simply a political position.
Well, Aaron, thank you for your call. Stuart Taylor, at least one thought there about from a member of the public about maybe time for term limits with justices.
Well, I think term limits is a wonderful idea. I've thought that for 20 or 30 years. Maybe 11 years, maybe 15 years and out. The problem is it'll never happen because it would require, if maybe a constitutional amendment, but even getting it through Congress. The calculations by the political people who could decide whether to have term limits are going to be who's going to be helped, who's going to be hurt, whose people are older, whose terms are later. Is it going to help the red team or the blue team? And there will always be a calculation where if one side thinks it's going to be a good thing for their team, the other side will think it's going to be a bad thing, and neither side's going to care much about the inherent merits of term limits, which are good. People shouldn't be sitting on the Supreme Court for 40 years. That's what we're going to be seeing for a long time.
Well, let's go to Troy, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. You're on the air, Troy.
Thank you very much. I will remind people, Lindsey Graham supported Kagan for Obama. And keep in mind that the Supreme Court's role is to make the wrongs of the government against its people fixed. So I think this is an injustice for the nominee, that what he's going through. Thank you very much.
Troy, thank you for your call. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi. I guess when I figured that I called the legitimacy of the Supreme Court into question was during Obergefell, when I realized that it was only up to a couple of justices whether or not I got the right to marry my partner. And now I'm kind of seeing that play out again, where there's a lot of decisions that could come up. And it's not even that it's a right-left ideology. It seems like it's more playing down to the right is actually just a code word for religious. So it's a bunch of religious people on the right who want to overturn Roe, even though that may be impossible by some standards. They still want to do it, and they're willing to sacrifice anything to be able to even get that chance. When in reality, there's no scientific reason to do it. There was no scientific reason to prohibit gay people from marrying. It's just about what religious doctrine is actually going to sway the masses of the people.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you for your call. Dahlia Lithwick, you have a response to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think Joe just gave us the answer to Stewart's objection. You know, Stewart correctly makes the point that the Supreme Court has inserted itself into all the big ticket issues of the day. Excuse me. And I think, you know, what you just heard was, no, the Supreme Court was by design supposed to be a counter-majoritarian check. It was supposed to fight for the rights of minorities when the other branches of government may have wanted to impose their will on majorities. That's what Obergefell was. That's what Brown v. Board was. And it's very, very hard to say, oh, we want the court to stay out of the big ticket battles, the hot button social issues, because in some sense, the court is really the only defense for people who seek to have those kinds of rights effectuated. So it's very, very hard to say that, you know, that shouldn't matter.
Christopher Schmidt, I'm curious. I mean, I think you can make an argument that ideology has long played a part on the United States Supreme Court. And I don't mean to say ideology in the pejorative. I mean, legal perspectives are formed through a multiplicity of ways. But what's the difference between that and the politics that I think people are reacting so strongly to and distastefully to right now?
Yeah, well, the big distinction we need to make is between ideology and partisan identity. So politics can capture ideological commitments. Politics can also capture partisan affiliation. So I think our concern here is not when the court becomes seen as in some way a political body, because it's just unquestionable that in at least some regard, politics defined as ideology, that's exactly what it is, and it really has always been. But when people just see it as reduced to a partisan institution, right, the red team and the blue team fighting it out, well, that is when its legitimacy becomes up for grabs, because it becomes no different than the other political branches. So I think one problem we have here is the language that we use to describe what's going on, a politicized court, can mean different things. One, it can mean a very realistic assessment of what the court does, or it can mean something which is trending in a very dangerous direction.
Mm. Stewart Taylor, I want to come back to something that you said earlier about your concern is that if we keep going down this road, that we're going to end up with a Supreme Court that's essentially impotent in its power and influence in American life. To that point, I just wanted to read a quote from you from something that Senator Ben Sasse wrote in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, he said he's talking about the fact that he doesn't think that lawmaking is done adequately in Congress itself. So he said the consequence of this transfer of power is that people yearn for a place where politics can actually be done. When we don't do a lot of big political debating here in Congress, we transfer it to the Supreme Court. And that's why the court is increasingly a substitute political battleground. We badly need to restore the proper duties and the balances of power to our constitutional system. That's Senator Ben Sasse in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, so Stuart Taylor, if you agree, maybe you agree with that. And if so, what can or should Congress be doing to restore that balance?
Well, I do agree with it. whether the balance can be restored is a harder question. Certainly, Congress has abdicated the role of chief lawmaker in many ways because they're paralyzed, because they spend more time raising money to get reelected than thinking about serious policy issues for all sorts of reasons that have been apparent for many years. So there's a void which the court has stepped forward to fill of who's going to make the big policies. And I think they've stepped forward to fill it all too readily. For example, I'm pro-choice on abortion, but the Supreme Court in 1973 in Roe versus Wade revolutionized the law of abortion, suddenly make it, you know, the most protective abortion rights of any nation in the world overnight. Mm. Now, that has a consequence, and the consequence has been to create a poisonous battle in our politics ever since 1973, where, you know, all the time people are thinking about how do we get the Supreme Court to overrule Roe versus Wade, or how do we get the Supreme Court to protect Roe versus Wade. I think Obergefell is a little different because I don't think many people are really all that determined to prevent gay marriage. I'm in favor of gay marriage. I think it was a big reach for the Supreme Court to take it over. After all, President Obama had been against gay marriage not very long ago. But You know, so they've revolutionized the law there. I don't think it will be nearly as controversial as abortion because, you know, most people, you know, I think gay marriage is a good thing and most people are starting to figure that out.
Public perception, public opinion has moved in that direction as well. Dahlia Lithwick, look forward here with me. I mean, regardless of what happens with Judge Brett Kavanaugh, and there are obviously so many uncertainties with that, what do you think the immediate future holds for the court? It doesn't seem as if it's going to be able to shake this concern about the politicization of its very decisions that it makes anytime soon.
Well, I think it goes back to how you opened, which is with Elena Kagan saying, trust me, the court knows that this is happening. In the year and a half that the court was a 4-4 enterprise, they were at tremendous pains. Across the board, I mean, from John Roberts to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both Sam Alito and Steve Breyer at the time said, you know, nothing to see here. We can do this with 8 justices. So I think that the court itself as an institution goes into a self-protective mode.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but on the point you were just making, I guess what I really wanted to ask is, I've heard Stewart say a couple of times that he thinks that the court has injected itself too forcefully in some very controversial issues. But a lot of people would say that because of the failures in Congress, it's the only place where they can seek remedy. And do you think that the court would be far less willing to take on those kinds of cases?
I think so. I think when I talk about self-protection, what I mean is staying out of, you know, the epicenter of the abortion debate, of affirmative action, staying out of probably voting rights and some of the racial justice issues. They may just contract the institutional space for the foreseeable future until we forget.
Mm. Well, Christopher Schmidt, we've got about 30 seconds left here to go. Last thought goes to you. If we do see a sort of contraction from the United States Supreme Court, I mean, is that a good thing or a bad thing? What do you think?
You know, it really comes down to where you come out in the particular issues that they're contracting themselves on. I mean, from my perspective, I think pulling back on some of these issues in which they could be moving toward in the coming years would probably be okay. It'd certainly be institutionally beneficial. And then the question is, who are the people whose cases are not getting a full hearing? And that just comes down to the kind of cases that are coming up to the court.
Yeah. It makes me wonder that we keep coming back to this question, and perhaps for now there's no answer, though. Like, if the problem really stems from the nomination process, the lack of a supermajority, the politics that are being played out with virtually every nominee now, this is a problem that is going to stay with the Supreme Court for a long time to come. Well, Christopher Schmidt, professor of law at the Chicago Kent College of Law and legal historian and co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Stuart Taylor, author and contributing editor for the National Journal. Stuart Taylor, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
And Dahlia Lithwick, courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast. Dahlia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.